Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. 3 decades ago, today's guest, award-winning investigative environmental journalist Mark Shapiro, was one of the few journalists writing about the impact of narrowing genetic diversity in seeds. In his new book, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply, he writes, quote, "None of us could have anticipated the alarming forces that have put this process on warp speed, just as the never-before-seen growing conditions call out for a broader selection of seeds. There's been a steady shrinking of options as control over them slips to barely a handful of global companies, all of which specialize in substances that kill plants and other organisms," end quote. Today, more than half of all commercially traded seeds have fallen under the control of just 3 multinational agrochemical companies. Mark Shapiro says one major result has been the disappearance of seed diversity at a time when we require a broader genetic spectrum to adapt to the volatile impacts of our changing climate. So what do we need to know about the struggle for the Earth's most important resource? Mark Shapiro is an award-winning investigative journalist specializing in the environment. He's the author of 3 books. His latest is Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. He's been writing about the environment since the early 80s. And Mark Shapiro joins us in studio. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, great to have you. Congratulations on this important book. Before we dive in and talk about seeds, because this is all so connected, I just want to get your take on California's devastating fires.
Oh, my God. Well, first of all, it's been heartbreaking to this tragedy that's unfolding just 150 miles east of us here in San Francisco. And aside from the humanitarian disaster underway, it has made me think of the incredible volatility that we see, that people talk about in the context of the fires. We've been seeing unprecedented heat, unprecedented dryness, patterns, ecological patterns that we've never seen before that are leading to this absolutely just horrific set of fires, recent fires, has got me thinking also about seeds in this way, because actually what I write about in the book is the incredible volatility that we are seeing in the world's food-growing lands. And I'm not trying to make a kind of an easy comparison, that the fire itself is horrendous enough, but when you think about the volatile conditions that have led to the breadth, depth, ferocity of the fires, which are related deeply to climatic changes that have helped contribute to those conditions, one of the things to think about is how those same conditions that have helped spur this incredible these incredible fires that just devastated California in so many different ways, those same conditions are now happening in the food-growing lands of the world. And I mean the conditions, meaning the conditions of drought, of rising temperatures, of depleted soils that are no longer able to protect us from such things. So when I think about the fires, I think about, in addition to the humanitarian disaster, it's a very powerful way to understand the stress that the Earth is under and which we are feeling.
Can you elaborate on that? Because Pacific Standard had a story about how farm workers have been working throughout the fires, and various organizations are trying to pass out masks to try to just give them some, you know, help from all of the potential health crisis that we're all facing right now. But what was interesting also in that piece is that the farmers said, "We're so afraid of what these fires are going to do to the fruits and vegetables, and so therefore, the farm workers have to keep picking." So can you talk about that? Because I think for a lot of people, this is somewhat new information.
Well, it highlights the deep inequities of our food system.
Right.
So on the one hand, those of us who have been able to afford masks have been walking around in this completely bizarre, surreal picture of protecting ourselves. We were able to protect ourselves. And if you're working in the fields, picking the fruits and vegetables that feed people around the world, you have nowhere close to this kind of protection. And those, and it's also interesting to note what the owners of these fields are telling us, aside from not providing masks, which I think is just incredible. It's just outrageous that you wouldn't provide basic protections to people who are working for you. But in addition to that, what you have, and I explored this in the book, is a high and rising awareness of how profoundly the conditions are changing in those fields, and that is requiring farmers to take whole new practices that they've never tried before, try new foods they've never tried before. There's a whole emerging understanding that comes deeply from the kind of the realms of agroecology and a deeper understanding that it's actually crops that are planted in more organically rich material that are actually far better able to withstand the environmental stresses that we're seeing. And I describe that in the this phenomenon in the book because in many ways what many of us have assumed who are sensitive to the food you eat, you know, that, that pesticides are not good for your health, have assumed that these products are healthier and better for the environment. Now what we're seeing, and I've described this in the book, is that over 20 years we've had longitudinal studies, and we're starting to see that basically farms that are planted in with a diverse variety of seeds, with much more organic material in the soil, are able to bounce back from environmental traumas. And that is a critical factor as we move forward into,
Well, as you write, I mean, when we think about our food system, we usually think about the final product, not the seed that actually created the product, right? Whether it's apples, you name it. And so why don't we just go back to the basics? Talk about what a seed actually is.
Thank you. Thank you. Finally, everybody, we need to get back to the idea of what a seed is. And I would tell people, you know, I worked on this book for several years, and I talked to a lot of people, and I told people I was writing a book about seeds, and the next words out of their mouths was, oh, you're writing about Monsanto. And I said, no, I'm writing about seeds. Monsanto is a player in this picture. There's no question about it. I decided I couldn't write a book about seeds without writing about Monsanto,
right.
So they're in there. But the book is about this fundamental life force on the earth from which we all, which enable all of us to have life, not just humans, but all organisms on earth are dependent on the basic powerful forces of a seed, which when you think about it, I like to think about a seed. I like to think when I wrote this, that actually from within a seed, the way you could look at a tree and actually see the rings of a tree, which could tell you about the historic evolution of a tree, and you can understand a lot of what those, what the conditions were for a tree over dozens, hundreds of years are told in the way that those rings articulate themselves within a tree. And it was interesting to begin to think about a seed that way, that if you unpack a seed and you actually can understand what's inside, you can actually feel, you can actually sense, or you can actually, it's harder to visualize because they're very small, but contained in those packets of kinetic energy, which I think of them as these packets of kinetic energy. You see the evolution of genetic characteristics that have evolved to survive essentially in different conditions. And so each seed in that way tells a story and tells us a story about what's within. And when you think about a seed, think about it like this, of these incredible packets of kinetic energy, and what they need to actually come to life is sunlight, water, and soil. And then, of course, we just bought some bamboo, and I realized, oh, my God, there are some plants that don't even need soil. but basically, you have water, sun, and for most plants, soil, which is soil means minerals and organisms in the soil from which they can. And you those have those three ingredients, and you get a plant. And the amazing thing is that plant just comes up from the earth and provides us with sustenance. It also provides us with beauty and with medicine and all the other things. So I think You know, I started writing a book investigating partly the consolidation of control of the seed industry and, of course, the climatic effects across the world, the climatic disruptions. And then I realized I was writing a book essentially about biodiversity, about the importance of biodiversity and what it means that we're losing biodiversity and the fight for to retain a diverse array of seed options. And then I realized that I was writing a book about ecology because this is all about number one, the stresses that the earth is under on ecological systems, which is how plants grow. They're based on ecological, deep ecological principles. And what it means to be attempting to kind of remove seeds from ecological, fundamental ecological processes, which is part of the consequence, I think, of the corporate consolidation, this business. So you start with the seed and you get pretty quickly into the much bigger stories about ecological processes and power in this country and in the world.
Right. You write that like all environmental stories start with a seed and you quickly end up in the realms of money and power. Who has it and who's struggling to gain or regain it? And of course, you end up in the realm of science. And we'll get there in a minute. But I also want to ask you about a fact that's on the cover, the inside cover of your book, and that is 3/4 of the seed varieties on Earth in 1900 had become extinct by 2015. 3/4 of the seed varieties on Earth in 1900 had become extinct by 2015.
Yes, this is a very powerful, sobering fact. And it comes from the Food and Agriculture Organization, which studies this stuff, from the UN. And what that tells us is, a lot of the extinction of seeds has come from, one, the expansion of human settlements, which have been obviously high speed since 1900, paving over wetlands and numerous things which you can imagine, and as well as changing conditions, naturally changing ecological conditions. Some seeds go extinct and others don't. And really accelerating over the past really 30 to 40 years is the emergence of this very narrowing control over the seeds themselves, as major big companies have gone in and bought small seed companies and actually taken their seeds off the market and replaced them with these kind of big, these seeds intended to kind of grow over massive quantities of land and are completely dependent on chemicals to survive. So there are multiple forces that have led to the extinction of seeds since 1900. And now, what I think is central to understand and what I write about in the book is that there is a fight over who is going to control the seeds that remain. Hmm. So if we're left with, let's say, about 1/4 of the seeds that we hear in 1900, still a lot of seeds. I mean, that's, you know, we're talking massive quantities of seeds, basically. A lot have been gone extinct. But now the fight is over who is going to control those seeds that remain. And that's, and this is in my book, I describe, on the one hand, it's an investigation into the consequences of who controls seeds and a journey into the kind of incredible global struggle that's actually happening now to retain autonomy over seeds.
Today we are speaking with investigative journalist Mark Shapiro about his new book, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. And Mark reports that more than half of all commercially traded seeds have fallen under the control of just 3 multinational agrochemical companies. And one major result has been the disappearance of seed diversity, just at a time when we require a broader genetic spectrum to adapt to climate change. 3 multinational chemical companies dominate half of the global seed market. DowDuPont, it's now DowDuPont, right?
Yeah.
Bayer Monsanto and Syngenta Chem. So these,
yes,
the major mergers here.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, one of the things that actually spurred my interest in writing this book was, in the past, I've written about climate change and some of the major ecological and economic consequences of climate change in this book, Carbon Shock. I think I spoke with you about it a while ago. Mm-hmm. And in the process, realized that there were huge shifts taking place in the conditions in food-growing lands, as there are on the Earth. Basically, we're getting to radically truncate those conditions. It's getting hotter and it's getting drier. And what does that mean in food-growing lands? So on the one hand, you have the shifting conditions. On the other hand, I was watching this concentration of control in the seed industry, and it was in 2017 when it came to this apotheosis, and God knows what's going to happen next, which is that the three largest seed companies in the world were controlled by the world's three largest agricultural chemical companies. So basically, the three companies have one thing in common, and I'll just list them for you. Monsanto, of course, was absorbed by Bayer, which is Germany's second biggest agricultural chemical company, and now Monsanto, Bayer's the biggest seed company in the world. You've got Dow, DuPont, big American companies, and then you've got Syngenta, which is a Swiss company, which is now in 2017 taken over by ChemChina, which is the biggest chemical company of China. So what's the common thread between those three companies? They are all primarily chemical companies. So they are seed company divisions within chemical companies. So basically, the companies that are responsible for producing the majority of the world's commercial seeds are chemical companies. And that has a number of enormous consequences, but two of those consequences are that that basically they are, and I've described this in the book, and I've talked to plant breeders, I've talked to, went up to UC Davis, a big center of plant breeding thinking, and many other places. And one of the most poignant things to think about in terms of the consequences is that those companies manufacture seeds that are dependent on their chemicals. So basically, they are producing crack baby seeds, is what I call them. Basically, they're born completely addicted to chemicals, dependent on pesticides and herbicides in order to survive. So that means we're pretty much on an intense chemical treadmill, which has all sorts of horrible collateral damage to our health. And but at the same time, they've been buying up local seed companies, eliminating local seed varieties and replacing them with these kind of crack baby seeds, which are completely dependent on chemicals to survive, and which also take those seeds out of the ecological ebb and flow of forces and replace that with a set of chemicals that create this kind of artificial environment. And so I think that those converging forces are extreme. So when I wanted to understand, what is the implication of such a narrow array of companies controlling our seeds? Because don't forget, they control our seeds. They control our food.
Right.
Yeah.
How did these chemical companies get into this lucrative seed business?
Well, that was helped along by a bunch of legal offensives in the starting in the 1980s, when an extremely important series of Supreme Court decisions, which essentially affirmed the ability of companies to patent life processes. So basically, you had companies coming up with new inventions, quote unquote, which included new bacteria that could eat oil and various other inventions, which they wanted to patent so that they could market. And in very important Supreme Court decisions in the mid 80s, the court said, yes, indeed, you can patent a life force, a life process. And that was soon applied to seeds. Suddenly, companies realized, oh my God, we can patent the seeds that we breed and get protection, legal protection in that regard. And what was the first company to realize this, and I talk about this in the book, was back in the 1980s, a small little company based in St. Louis, tiny little chemical company, mostly known for manufacturing napalm, was called Monsanto. And Monsanto realize that the sequence of decisions that it could actually begin to patent seeds and make the seeds dependent on its own chemicals. And this was a fundamental shift. And so basically starting in the mid to late 80s, you had this accelerating awareness of chemical companies that began to see the possibilities of creating seeds connected to their chemicals. And then came along genetic engineering by the early 90s, in which seeds were literally genetically manipulated to express certain characteristics. And then we were off to the races on the patenting business. And I went down to the U.S. Patent Office in Virginia on this delightful little cul-de-sac, and I think it's in Arlington, the U.S. Patent Office. You can go down there yourself. And by the way, there's actually a little cool little museum, and they show like the nation's first patent was like under George Washington for like potash fertilizer or something. Anyway, I looked through the patenting records, and you could see how basically starting in the 90s, the entities being granted patents, it used to be little kind of farm breeders at their home and their farm coming up with kind of new seed varieties that they would patent. And then you could see the names like Monsanto and Dow, DuPont emerging, and they are the ones now dominate that. And that's how we got here.
How could these companies patent something that has existed in the public domain?
Well, that's a very good question. And there's a lot of criticisms that people say. I mean, seeds evolve, and that's one of the fundamental characteristics of a patent is that it's supposed to be original. In other words, not just original but reproducible. And if you actually have a live organism that theoretically is changing over many generations, this is a serious problem. But they basically argued that we were inventing new things that hadn't existed before and therefore need a patent. I explain this in great detail in the book about how these patenting deals were done.
Today we're speaking with investigative journalist Mark Shapiro about his new book, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. And let's take a call before we go to break. Let's go to GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hi, GS. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I'm back, Rose. I'm sorry. I have called too often in the past. Mark and Rose, thank you so much for this program. Let me get straight to it. Cannot the public have a serious impact on this by simply requiring that all genetically manipulated organisms be labeled as such? That's my question.
Well, yes, I obviously write about this fight in the book. And as you probably know, there's been a big battle in states across this country as well as on a national level to compel food companies to label the products that contain genetically modified ingredients. I think what the industry is afraid of is that they know that consumers are not going to go for this. And so they are extremely wary of ever letting this happen. And there's been one effort after another defeated by industry lobbying efforts. There is something, by the way, that was ultimately passed at the federal level, which is which was proposed with the support of some of the seed companies as a way to subvert more tight regulations. And now there is supposed to be a rule that's supposed to go into force in the next year or two, in which supermarkets and such include labels, but they don't have to state it on the label. It's accessible like through the internet. You're supposed to be able to scan a little barcode on every can of corn while you're in the supermarket, and that's supposed to tell you whether it contains GMOs. It was an effort to actually divert more significant labeling efforts. But if you were to compel labeling and serious labeling, you would basically I think poll after poll after poll after poll, and actually the same things happen in Europe where there are serious restrictions on GMOs, you would see probably a big public recoiling from purchasing goods that contain genetically modified food, which would have an impact of diminishing the leverage that the companies that the big seed companies have over our seeds and our food.
Well, thank you for calling GS. Please feel free to call anytime. Today, we're joined by investigative journalist Mark Shapiro, author of Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. You can also podcast our show. Find information, kalw.org. Today, we are speaking with investigative journalist Mark Shapiro about his new book, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. Mark is an award-winning investigative journalist who's been writing about the environment since the early 1980s. And the website for his book just launched. You can find it at seedsofresistance.net. And it's a beautiful website full of a lot of information about this very important issue. We have a number of callers on the line, Mark. So let's go to our next caller, Kenneth in San Francisco. Hi, Kenneth.
Good morning, Rose. Thank you for the show. First-time caller, yay.
All right, thank you.
A question for Mr. Shapiro about extinction of seeds. I'm assuming you're referring to all seed types, and in that case, for seeds that have to do with edibles, are not seeds that are quote-unquote extinct actually being saved in the seed bank that is in northern Norway? I'll take the answer offline. Thank you very much.
Whew. Okay. There's a lot contained in your question, sir. So let me just first of all, very good question, because when we say three-quarters of seeds since 1900, is that specifically food crops or not? No, it is not specifically food crops. It is all seeds on the earth. So that includes a whole array of seeds leading to all forms of different plants. And for example, in the tropics, when you turn a rainforest into a soybean field, you lose seeds. When you pave a parking lot over a wetland, you lose seeds. It's just the numerous kind of extrapolations from there. What's very important in this regard, number one, is the kind of ecological consequence of losing so many different elements of an ecological system. But two, very important to actually understand that actually seeds for food are not simply one particular seed. So, for example, a seed will, what there's growing recognition is how important the wild relatives. I love this term. It's wild because everybody has a wild relative here and there. But they're also the same thing in plants. Plants have wild relatives. So I'll tell you a quick story about some very important wild relatives that were discovered that are now saving the American wheat crop. And that was in and I write about this in the book, and I go into some detail into this, is that there has been a very important seed bank. There was a very important seed bank, believe it or not, in the city of Abu Ghraib in Iraq. And some of you might remember the horrible associations we now have with Abu Ghraib about this prison that Americans set up during the invasion. Well, also, there was a seed bank there. And that seed bank contained seeds that had evolved within the Fertile Crescent. Mm-hmm. Fertile Crescent, you remember from Geography 101, was center of domesticated agriculture. So that seed bank was destroyed. Before it was destroyed, those seeds were taken across the border into Syria, and it was a seed bank outside of Aleppo. And that seed bank functioned for about 5 or 6 years outside of Aleppo until the war came to Aleppo. And the seeds, again, spirited out of that seed bank across the border into Lebanon. And those seeds are now being grown in Lebanon. Number one, why are they important? They are important not only because all seeds are important, but because the seeds that have grown up in areas that are hot and dry, we're talking the Middle East here, are getting to be more and more and more important to the future as more and more of the food-growing lands become hot and dry. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you the end, and I describe this in the book, it's a very dramatic tale because many of those seeds from Syria, which are include wild relatives of, I learned a whole new universe, wild relatives of wheat, which are these incredible grasses that grow across the Middle East and different other parts of the world. One of those wild grasses now turns out to be the most resistant to a pest that's been showing up in Kansas in the United States. And a pest has been following the heat into the American Midwest. It's called the Hessian fruit fly, has been devastating huge parts of the American wheat crop, and they've been doing furious tests at the University of Kansas in the United States, in the Midwest, and realizing that the one seed that has resistance to this bug is the wild wheat grass from Syria that is now actually being bred into the American wheat crop. So when you think of what the impact is of extinction, we're talking about seeds that both are directly related to food but also carry these characteristics that are centrally important to the vitality of our seed system.
This is really amazing. How is all of this information being shared?
Well, I'm trying to do that now, Rose.
But I mean, if you have, like you write about this, one of the world's most important seed banks used to be located in Syria, and it affects what's happening in Oklahoma, Texas, Colorado. Are these various researchers talking to each other about their findings? Is there a place where people can follow and track what they're discovering?
Yes, they can. They could, I hate to put it this way, but they could read my book because it's very, I talk to a lot of these people,
yeah.
And you're right that nobody's, rarely does a journalist call them because they're amazing studies in different agricultural journals and stuff. There's a very lively discussions. There's actually very lively exchanges of germplasm between one ecological region and others. There are quite a network of seed banks in the world where this kind of research is being done. And I made a very specific point with the book of making sure that I have to say, to create a compelling narrative, I tell a lot of stories about people and individuals and situations, but all of the ecological information, the scientific information, the findings that you're referring to, Rose, are footnoted. So if you really want sources, there are a lot of them in the book, and they come from the grand, from some of the top scientific journals in the world, to the experiences of people, including Native American people and others who are actually forging or increasing attention is being paid to how they're growing food.
Well, since you brought that up, why don't we talk about Paul Nabon, one of the world's leading ethnobotanists and an acclaimed expert in desert agriculture. You write that he's at the forefront of efforts to respond to these changing conditions by returning to basic principles, looking not to company labs for the most successful crops, but back to Native Americans.
Yes, I mean, this was part of the really eye-opening part, or one of the eye-opening parts of doing this research was to actually understand how top people in this, farmers and thinkers and researchers, were actually beginning to realize rather belatedly how, at least in North America, Native people, guess what? They've been growing food for thousands of years, for example, in the American Southwest, where the conditions are what? Hot and dry. Mm. And so actually suddenly this, it's like this alarm, this crazy like light went off in the American Southwest as well as elsewhere. And they realized, oh, man, maybe the Native people can teach us some things. Mm. And so that's been an eye-opening experience to realize how much how people are starting to look back to people who've been hiding in plain sight here in America. And one of them is Gary Paul Nabhan, who you cite. He's a top ethnobotanist who actually spent many, many years studying desert agriculture, which, and nobody paid attention to him until, broadly speaking, he's very highly respected in this field, but he's starting to get a lot more attention because many parts of the world are becoming desert-like. And so he has an experimental farm down in southern Arizona that I went to, which is really amazing, showing this incredible diversity of different fruit and vegetable crops, trees, miniature apple trees, pomegranate trees, chilies, lettuce, that he's growing in the high desert of Arizona under a USDA grant program. And in the process of doing that is also working very closely with some of the native tribes in Arizona who and New Mexico who have been doing this work for many, 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 many generations. And so in a sense, what these extreme environmental stresses are doing are forcing us, and us, I mean, not only us in this room or in this city, but people who are actually trying to respond to these dramatically shifting conditions, to look to how food has been grown in conditions where they didn't have pesticides and herbicides to rely on to kill all the organisms, all the threatening organisms. And they're finding there's a lot to be learned from these approaches. And I describe that in the book, and it's been an incredible flourishing of information and exchanges from native communities to, you could say, the mainstream, the botanical communities.
Mm-hmm. What else did you learn? You write that NABHAN works with First Nation Navajo, Apache, Hopi, Tohono, Oodham, mm-hmm. who have farmed the lands of southern Arizona and New Mexico for many generations. They offer access to seeds and accumulated knowledge of how to grow them, for which NABHAN offers insights from the modern agricultural sciences, the latest in non-chemical pest and disease control.
Yes, and he is involved in this exchange where he offers whatever knowledge can be gleaned from modern agricultural sciences, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. It's not all dependent on chemicals. It's very sophisticated people, and there's this kind of exchange. And the basic underlying concept is, I think, what it now has an actual formal term, which is kind of agroecology, although it's not that new. It's been around for a long time. But I think native people were doing this without calling it something. it was just like survival, figure out how to make it work in a dry situation. And in that case, there's a lot of, I mean, people are probably familiar with the three important crops of many native communities, which is beans, corns, and squash. And what's interesting about this combination, which is found to be very successful in these kind of settings, is the exchanges of nutrients that occur under the soil. So there's one plant absorbs nutrients, another one excretes nutrients, and this kind of compatibility that occurs, much more ability to absorb water. Many of the crops are more deeply rooted than the commercial crops because that enables them to actually seek more deeply into the soil. And many have adapted mechanisms for responding to heat and drought by almost literally contracting during periods of extreme drought. Their metabolisms contract and then emerge back when the water appears. So there is a huge amount that's actually being learned, which I describe, of course, in the book, not only in America, but thankfully, finally, here in America, where this has been happening for thousands of years. The South American Southwest is like the oldest cultivated agriculture in North America, basically, in New Mexico and Arizona. But similar things are happening in Africa and are happening in Asia, basically, where people are going back to these basic ideas. Mm-hmm. And one thing I think very important to remember is the why does that make a difference in this climatic moment? It would make a difference anyway. But what climate change is doing is actually highlighting the vulnerabilities of the industrial agriculture system. It's actually showing that actually devising a set of seeds to respond to a set of to basically be grown in a set of conditions with the assistance of various chemicals and stuff, the conditions are outpacing the ability of the big seed companies to even respond to those conditions. So mm-hmm. we have the highest level of volatility we've ever seen. And what that volatility means is that in many ways the big seed companies cannot even keep up with this level of kind of high fluctuations in conditions. And what's been shown over and over and over again, and I show it in the fields and I go to some of the backup science to illustrate this, is that it's seeds that are diverse, a diverse variety of seeds growing in kind of organically rich soils that are able to actually have a response mechanism to the conditions, and thereby certain varieties that are able to withstand this high volatility continue to grow. And study after study are showing that these are the farms with the highest resilience to environmental trauma.
Wow. Well, you touched on that just a minute ago, but can you talk more about how these seeds are so resilient?
Yes. I mean, first of all, there's no magic seed. There's no magic seed that's going to go like, wow, this is going to survive a drought. But what is clear is that, and there have been actually numerous efforts to actually articulate and understand this deeper. But what we're finding is that by having a diverse populations of seeds, some plants are actually going to be killed by heat or drought or whatever they are. But the seeds that survive are going to actually pass along those characteristics to a broader population of seeds. And by actually seeing what survives through these kind of highly volatile situations, they are able to actually bounce back through trauma. And one of the most important things is it's interesting, the role of organic material in soil. Mm. What was happening in the tail ends of the Obama administration? Remember the Obama administration? It was just here till about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the USDA realized that it was paying billions of dollars out to farmers due to climate change-related conditions. They're paying tens of billions of dollars out for conditions that the USDA itself said were related to climate change, drought, heat, et cetera, extremes of weather. And so they started trying to understand the best way to respond to this situation, partly driven by the finances. The crop insurance system was on the edge of collapse, basically, and came out with a set of guidelines, which I talk about here in the book, which sound like a bunch of hippies in Sonoma, like, came up with them. It's basically about, like, and this is from the USDA now talking, the USDA saying we need farms with much more varieties of seeds, more organic material in the soil, which enables water to be absorbed. It just doesn't roll off the soil like it does now. And a whole set of guidelines which tell us that this is the most effective way to deal with climatic change, which is exactly the opposite way that the three big seed chemical companies are headed.
Mm. The hippies are usually right.
It takes a while, but people realize after time. Yeah.
Today we're speaking with investigative journalist Mark Shapiro, author of Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. Let's go next to Ariana in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Yes, I can't help but be struck by the fact that plant life is so generous and giving to us without end, and that when we look for technological fixes, that it's often really without heart. And I'm related to that. When we look at the GMO battle and the labeling battle, it seems almost analogous to people denying climate change. It's a deviation from what we really need to be doing now, which is a form of civil disobedience and boycotting GMOs nationwide. It's a totally different venture and an act of engagement that would bring people together. We're conversely waiting for corporations to do the right thing. We have to up our intensity and the level of our efforts and sacrifice, because there's a literal war going on over not only the food supply but all life on the planet, including human life. Thank you.
Well, I can't disagree with your overall sentiment. I think that's what I really wanted to spend time with in the book is was not only the challenge and the ecological challenge presented by the corporate consolidation, but also the incredible battle that's going on all across the world, all across in this country and around the world, to actually retain autonomy over seeds. And kind of eye-opening to me, actually. I didn't know this whole world was out there, but all across this country you have kind of seed banks that are emerging, and everywhere from Sonoma and Petaluma in our area, fantastic seed library in the Richmond Public Library, which I visited, and all the way through the Southwest, incredible kind of seed collection, some of the native seeds that I was talking about earlier, collected at a seed bank in Tucson, outside of Tucson, and at New England, the middle of Iowa, there's fantastic collection of seeds. So huge efforts by members of the public and farming communities to actually retain those local seeds that we're talking about, and to pursue a different forms of agriculture. Here, even in Berkeley, we have the Berkeley Food Institute and other places that are actually doing really far-reaching kind of look at an agriculture that has far less collateral environmental damage and works more closely with ecological conditions. So your point is well taken. I think there is a it's why the book is called Seeds of Resistance. It would be a double entendre, since on the one hand, resistant seeds, but also there is a movement afoot, and about half the book is about this incredible movement of seed, of people saving their seeds and planting them.
Mm. Yeah, thank you so much for calling in, Ariana. There's great stories about the seed banks here in the United States. Many. Do we know how many?
Well, they're all different sizes and different, you know, yeah, but there are probably dozens. Mm. And I wrote a piece that's also elements included in the book about the incredible profusion of seed libraries across this country, so many of which are in, like, public libraries. Mm. You know, you can check out a book and you can check out a seed. And so what's important is, one, that is happening on a very local level, and it's very powerful, and I have a lot of details in the book and even groups and stuff that you could be in touch with. And then that impulse is being affirmed over and over and over again by the science. You know, I had looked at things like the Agronomy Journal of this and the Journal of Agricultural Economics of that. And these deeply grounded scientific journals are also affirming these principles that are deeply ecological, which I think is also an important thing to remember. Yeah.
Let's go next to William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Thanks for holding.
Thank you. I'd like to start off with a gentle criticism. One is that phrases like eco, agro, biology, ethnocity, or whatever it is, really to the average individual are just word salad. People want to know what to do, how to light the candle instead of cursing the darkness. Now, I want to give you a concrete example of something that I observed that indicates that average people are making intelligent choices with respect to avoiding pesticides in food. I was shopping yesterday in, of all places, CVS Pharmacy, which is hardly an esoteric entity when it comes to food. They have a small food section, as you probably know. And I was astounded to find that they're selling organic products. Of all things, CVS Pharmacy selling organic products. Why are they doing that? The only reason they're doing that is because people want them. And if we simply will buy organic, which automatically eliminates the problems of GMO confusion, because there's no GMO in organics, we can, through economic pressure, create a situation where farmers want to grow organics. And if they want to grow organics, they'll grow organics, and the supermarkets only have limited shelf space, so if that's what people want, that's all that they'll handle. So I would appeal, people want to know what they can do this afternoon when they go shopping to have a significant effect. And economics...
Let me get Mark to reply. We're almost out of time. Thank you, William. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, obviously, they could go and just be aware, more aware of where their food comes from. There is this whole profusion. Organic happens to be the fastest growing sector of the food market. So I think people can actually go find organic. It's a very simple way to do it. I think actually having getting food from local sources can be very helpful. I think actually what's needed are on a because those are individual decisions, and I think everybody listening to the show is smart enough to figure out what their own individual shopping choices can be. What we need is actually a federal policy, which I know might seem ridiculous in this particular context, but I think California is making some moves in this direction to encourage a greater kind of diversity of sources and fields and more organic material in soils and more in order to deal with this kind of water crisis that we have here. So I think there's a lot going on, and you'll find it out as you look around, and of course I describe a lot in the book.
You do. And just final thoughts, Mark, about 30 seconds. I mean, we've got climate change. We have these big agri companies. And then we have hunger. You end your book talking about the hunger crisis around the globe.
Thank you. Can we please dispense with the kind of notion that we have to have these destructive practices to feed the hungry?
Right.
Which I do talk about.
So where do you see this going? I mean, if there's awareness raising, there are these movements, seeds, resistance.
I think as people realize how central seeds are to our food supply, they will actually begin to realize that actually how you plant, what you, the seeds you use determines how that seed is planted, who tends it, and who owns the food at the other end. And if you really think about it like that, a lot of things follow.
Mark Shapiro is an award-winning investigative reporter who has written about environmental issues since the early 80s. His latest book is Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. Mark, thank you for your work and thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for calling in, William. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. Thanks to Malihei Razazan for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. When Black Lives Matter activist Darnell Moore was 14, three boys from his neighborhood harassed him because they thought he was gay. They tried to set him on fire, but luckily he escaped. In his memoir, No Ashes in the Fire, Coming of Age, Black and Free in America, he tells his story and the stories of those on the margins. He also celebrates the lives of Black LGBTQ people who came before him. Join the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. We'll be right back.